morning. This is a WERU special, Chemicals Hacking Hormones and Fueling Epidemics, a talk by Dr. Leonardo Trasandi at the Shaw Institute in Blue Hill on July 3, 2019. Dr. Trasandi is an internationally recognized expert on EDCs and the author of the book Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. It was recorded by Matt Murphy and has been edited to fit this time slot.
I'm now going to turn this over to Michelle Berger. Michelle has been here quite a long time as Senior Research Associate, and it is thanks to Michelle, who read Dr. Trasandi's book, that inspired us to invite him to come and speak this evening. So I thought it would be appropriate if she did the introductions.
So for almost 30 years now, the staff of the Shaw Institute has been studying the presence and effects of man-made chemicals in one of the top marine predators in our region, the harbor seals. And many of the chemicals that we've found in the harbor seals here are, such as flame retardants, PCBs, pesticides, are the same chemicals that Dr. Trasandi wrote about in his book and he's likely to discuss this evening. So reading about the broad-reaching health effects of these chemicals in humans and knowing that they're also present in the harbor seals right here in the Gulf of Maine really brought home for me the connection between human health and ecosystem health. So currently here at the Shaw Institute, we're in the process of expanding our marine mammal contaminants research. We have started a project where we're collaborating with scientists from Sweden, Iceland, Greenland, and also Southern Illinois University to do an international comparative study focused on old and new flame retardants in 9 species of marine mammals from 3 ocean regions. So we're looking here at the Northwest Atlantic. We're also looking in the general Arctic region around Greenland and Iceland, and also the Baltic Sea. So we're still in the data analysis process, but we hope to be able to present these results to you sometime next year to give you a better understanding of the global implications of the environmental contaminants on the threatened marine mammal species. So with that, I'd like to introduce our speaker this evening. Dr. Leo Trasandi is the Jim G. Hendrick Associate Professor. He's the Director of the Division of Environmental Pediatrics. He's also Vice Chair of Research in the Department of Pediatrics at New York University. And he's a faculty member at the NYU Wagner School of Public Service and the College of Public Health. Dr. Trasandi is an internationally recognized leader in children's environmental health, and he leads one of 35 centers across the country as part of the National Institute of Health's Environmental Influences on Child Health Outcomes Program. He's also the author of the best-selling book, Sicker, Fatter, Poorer. And with that, please welcome Dr. Leo Trasandi.
Thank you so much, Michelle. It's a real delight to be here. I'll start by disclosing that Maine and this region in particular of Maine is near and dear to my heart for a number of reasons. My wife and I honeymooned in Bar Harbor in Acadia, and bringing my children back who are 11 and 9 has been a real joy this week. And in particular in that regard, I'm happy to communicate at least one of my two children has gotten, if you will, an environmentalist bug. In particular, his focus has been on climate change and ocean contaminants. In particular, he's been really focused on these horrible tragedies where you see fish literally being killed, their intestines being clogged, their airways being clogged by various plastic materials. And I'm not going to be talking about that specifically tonight, but there is a parallelism A thesis during this presentation is that what may actually be even a more compelling and urgent challenge in the here and the now, not to minimize what's going on when fish are killed by literally being contaminated with 3 trillion pieces of plastic in our ocean. But it's actually the chemicals from those plastics and from other materials in our daily lives that literally absorb into our bodies and wreak havoc and disarray on the basic molecular signals that underlie so many basic bodily functions. So our hormones are these natural molecules that are crucial for everything from temperature to healthy metabolism, salt, sugar, even sex. And when we're talking about endocrine disrupting chemicals, we're talking about synthetic chemicals that don't necessarily mimic. They can do a variety of things. They can literally hack those molecular signals, disrupt them, and thereby contribute to disease and disability. Now, we don't routinely test still synthetic chemicals in the way we should for their impact on human health. But what little we know is that there's now evidence for 1,000 synthetic chemicals that literally scramble these molecular signals and thereby contribute to disease and disability. And the evidence is strongest for 4 categories of chemicals: flame retardants, which are used in electronics and furniture; phthalates, which are used in cosmetics, personal care products, and food packaging; bisphenols, which are used in aluminum can linings and thermal paper receipts; and pesticides, which are used in agriculture. Now, if you haven't heard about this on breaking news on CNN or whatever media you watch to get your information, that might be a surprise, might not be a surprise. Well, part of the reason you haven't heard this is that the science here is very new. Yes, we've heard a lot about climate change, but in many ways, the science around endocrine disrupting chemicals is really cutting edge. The first report that sounded the scientific alarm was by the Endocrine Society, an association of 17,000 hormone specialists, scientists, doctors, etc., that put their first scientific statement on this issue in 2009. At the time, the findings were chiefly from wildlife and from the laboratory. Then in 2012, the World Health Organization and the United Nations Environment Program really put this issue on the global public health map as a profound threat. Then in 2015, the Endocrine Society was so immersed in 1,331 scientific references that were new, documenting in particular not just that this was affecting wildlife, but this was being found in humans to affect people's lives and thereby contribute to disease, that they wrote a second scientific statement. We don't usually write scientific statements every 6 years. They're not necessarily new, breaking, cutting-edge science. They're reviewing the scientific literature. But it was almost as if the 2009 report had changed so quickly. The state of the science has changed so quickly since then that there was a need to update that report in 2015. Then my own American Academy of Pediatrics in 2018 stepped up and put the alarm out about chemicals that are intentionally and unintentionally added to foods. And so this is how cutting edge this science is, and why maybe you haven't heard about this notion in the way that maybe we all should have already, but it's how recent the science has developed, say perhaps the climate change, where we might be 10 years behind the science of climate change with regard and the general awareness in that regard. So what do these chemicals do? Well, this evidence is strongest above all for these chemicals on the developing brains of young children, and in particular for pesticides and for flame retardant chemicals. They disrupt thyroid hormone. Now, we think of thyroid hormone as something that keeps our body warm. It's important for bone, it's important for muscle function, a variety of basic bodily functions. But babies don't make their own thyroid hormone until 25 weeks gestation. And we as pediatricians are so focused on thyroid hormone that when we have a baby recently born, we intentionally prick their heel to get a blood sample. That newborn blood spot that you've probably heard about for a variety of genetic screening and other newborn screening techniques is crucial, because if that child has a critically low thyroid hormone, you can treat that and thereby prevent the child from having a lifelong intellectual disability and an inability to contribute in the same way as they otherwise could in society. But it's no longer the reality that these are large-scale dysfunctions in thyroid hormone. After all, we're talking about, with congenital hypothyroidism, a complete absence of proper functioning of thyroid hormone. What we now know is subtle changes in thyroid hormone function due to these chemicals that are commonly detected in all of us. If I drew samples from, you guys are about 60 or 70 people here tonight, if I drew samples from all of you, I would detect these chemicals readily in blood and urine in 95 to 100% of you in all likelihood. What these chemicals do, in the clinically normal range, they shift the function of a mom's thyroid hormone. And because baby is relying on thyroid hormone, even in the clinically normal range, mind you, this is the range that we test routinely as obstetricians for thyroid hormone dysfunction in moms. So this means that we can't detect who's got a problem in the way that we normally would. This is actually causing dysfunction that can contribute to autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and cognitive deficits. Now, it's not all just about brain defects. I like to say that these chemicals affect 99% of us, even if 1% of us are actually aware of the issue in the here and the now. This is probably a large part of the 1% in the community of Blue Hill, with no offense to the broader community, but that's where we are in the awareness when it comes to endocrine disrupting chemicals. So in particular, we're talking about obesity, diabetes, for adults out there, prostate cancer, breast cancer, infertility, endometriosis, and fibroids are among the list of conditions. So if I asked you all to raise your hands if you have a family member affected by any of those conditions, you probably would all raise your hands. And in particular, the evidence is strongest and most rapidly rising with respect to chemicals that literally make us fatter. We now know of about 50 or so synthetic chemicals that can literally hack our metabolism and make us fatter. The prototype chemical for that group is a chemical that you may have heard about called bisphenol A or BPA. That's why these BPA-free cups have gotten a lot of attention in the media and supermarkets and what have you. In the laboratory, BPA makes fat cells bigger, disrupts the function of a protein that protects the heart called adiponectin, which, by the way, means it's been linked to heart disease as well in adults. And it's a synthetic estrogen and literally can have sex-specific effects on body mass, especially during vulnerable windows of development such as puberty. By the way, as a brief aside, probably the first alarm bell in the medical arena about endocrine disruption was a chemical you may have heard of that also has three letters, called DES, or diethylstilbestrol. So it's a synthetic estrogen given to pregnant women, especially in the 1940s and 50s, and even some in the 60s. But an astute clinician not far from here at Massachusetts General Hospital, who identified a cluster of a rare cancer in young girls that had not been recognized even in the history of the MGH, where they then looked at the case records and found the only distinction between the cancer cases and the non-cancer cases was the use of this pharmaceutical in utero, in pregnancy. And BPA, by the way, was considered as a pharmaceutical back in the 40s and 50s, but it wasn't potent enough. So instead of the DES story, we now have the BPA story. And so it's not just BPA that is a chemical of concern. There are these ubiquitous chemicals, the Teflon-like chemicals. We now call them in the media sometimes the forever chemicals because they stay in the body for years at a time and seem to be detected everywhere in soil, water. These are chemicals that are used for a long time in nonstick cooking. They're also used in a variety of athletic wear and other materials. And in a study of adult women in particular, but adult men as well, they found that adults who had successfully lost weight through healthy diet and physical activity gained more weight back in relationship to the level of the perfluoroalkyl chemicals, these PFOAs, or PFASs is the more technical term, that they measured in their serum after they had lost the weight. The higher the PFAS levels, the greater they gained that weight back. So nothing that I'm going to say here tonight mitigates the importance of diet, healthy diet and physical activity as important in stemming the tide of obesity and diabetes that we experience today. Similarly, a chemical we'll talk about that later as well that makes plastic softer, the phthalates, literally disrupts how the body metabolizes basic calorie intake. So I know you guys have had probably a few sandwiches on the way in, and we're thinking, well, that's going to go right into protein. Unfortunately, sometimes even through the contact, the chemicals that get absorbed into food through the processing, they literally contaminate these foods and ultimately tell our body, rather than make that food into protein and healthy muscle, it actually sends signals to the body through changes in how genes are expressed. There's this whole science of epigenetics that's behind this effect that I'm describing, that literally tells the body to ship that into calories or to carbohydrates or even fat as a result. So it's literally sending the false signals to the body, even when you're trying to do the right thing from a healthy diet and physical activity perspective. So you might ask, well, how did I even get into this field after all? Medical doctors, by the way, on average get 1 to 3 hours of environmental health in their conventional training. And it's true, I didn't get any special training. I didn't have an undergraduate degree in environmental health. My undergraduate degree, by the way, was in chemistry, was in synthetic organic chemistry. So it's a bit of an odd full circle for me talking about this. But the story that really drove me into this work is that I was asked by the European Union to advise them about the costs of these chemicals on human health there. And so it was an honor, it was a privilege. I brought together a variety of scientists in Paris and other parts across the world. We put together 5 expert panels, toiled with the assistance of some wine, I might add, some of which is not unlike what we have here tonight before us. I'm happy that that legacy carries on. But suffice it to say that these expert panels found that diseases due to these chemicals don't just have human health impacts like I've described, they cost our economy 163 billion euros. That's roughly $200 billion a year. That's 1.2% of Europe's gross domestic product, our annual economic product in Europe, that gets wasted as a result of these chemicals. And that estimate was based on less than 5% of endocrine disrupting chemicals. Mind you, there are about 1,000. We focused on fewer than 50. A subset of diseases due to the few chemicals we studied, and a subset of costs due to the few diseases due to the few chemicals that we studied. So this is an underestimate of an underestimate of an underestimate, and it's an annual cost insofar as exposures are continuing at current levels. Now you're probably saying, hey, wait a minute, we're in Maine. This is the United States, right? I'm getting there. But there's a reason why I'm talking about Europe first, and that is, in many ways, we've lagged in the United States with respect to protecting people from these exposures through the political and policy process. So let's take, for example, the flame retardant chemicals that I talked about earlier. Flame retardants, if I pulled all of your blood, not all your blood, a little bit of blood from each of you, had to throw that in there, make sure you're awake. There's a lot of technical science here, so I've got to throw some curveballs in there. It is July, after all. But suffice it to say that if I drew this audience's blood to assess their exposure, your exposure to flame retardants, and then I did the same thing in Paris simultaneously, your levels would be in the 95th percentile compared to the French. And that's because back in 1975, California, yes, California, required that flame retardant, I'm a fan of California, don't get me wrong, flame retardant chemicals were intentionally added due to a law called TB-117. That was well-intentioned. It was intended to prevent people from dying from fires. I grew up in the West Village in Manhattan, and I literally saw somebody die because they smoked in their bed at night and fell asleep, and their apartment went ablaze. They died before they knew it. So I get that fires kill, and the intention of that California law was to avoid people from dying by slowing the spread of fire and giving people time to get out. The bad news is, it did not save any lives. nor did it actually do good. It actually did the opposite in this case. It did harm, because we have a legacy where we carry flame retardants and pass them on to the next generation in ways that affect their thyroid hormone function. So now let me bring this back to the cost in the United States. Because as an American, as a pediatrician, as a dad of two boys, leaving this European project, I said, well, what are the costs here? $340 billion a year, 2.3% of our gross domestic product, chiefly driven by the differences in flame retardants, where we have much greater exposure than the Europeans, where they never required the flame retardants be added. And they actually banned them before we did in the United States. And the biggest part of that $340 billion is due to flame retardants. I have some good news for you. This is not a depressing talk, and I'm about to give you the great things you can do, the safe and simple steps you can take to prevent your exposure now, and I'll give you an added cherry on top of hope at the end, by the way.
You're listening to Dr. Leonardo Trasandi, author of the book Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future, and What We Can Do About It, speaking at the Shaw Institute in Blue Hill on July 3rd.
When it comes to pesticides, you would think that we're not exactly doing great either. However, back in 1993, the Clinton administration proposed a Food Quality Protection Act that passed unanimously in both houses of Congress and required an additional safety factor for kids, on behalf of kids, that essentially mandated that levels of pesticides in food were much lower than our European counterparts, where even though bio and organic is a bit more of a market share there than in the US, the reality is when you measure pesticide levels in Americans and Europeans, the Europeans actually have higher levels. So the cost of pesticide exposure is $121 billion there and more like $47 billion here. It's not to say that I'm a dollars and cents guy purely. After all, I am a pediatrician and a dad. But it speaks to the reality that policies predict exposure. Exposure contributes to disease, and disease costs our economy. The other analogy I use is that if a child loses one IQ point, mom may not notice, no offense. The other parent may not notice, the teacher might not notice, the psychologist might not notice, but if 100,000 children come back from school with one less IQ point, the entire economy notices. Each IQ point is worth roughly 2% of a child's lifetime economic productivity. If on average a child makes $1 million over his or her lifetime, 2% of $1 million, $20,000. Then multiply that by 4 million kids born in the United States each year, and you're already in the range of $80 billion. And that's an annual cost, because children are born each year literally less or more able to contribute to society as a result. So I've given you a lot of sobering statistics and even a heavy dose of numbers, and before you run to get another glass of wine, the great news is that there are, you may want that anyway, but there are safe and simple steps we can all take to reduce these exposures in our own daily lives. So let's start with pesticides. Eating organic, in study after study, low-income populations as well as high-income populations, changes in diet towards an organic-based diet can reduce your levels of pesticides that are known to affect brain development in these children. And by the way, these are not shown just to affect brain development in psychological testing. They've actually done magnetic resonance images of children who are more and less exposed to pesticides. And the deficits are literally, the kids have parts of the brain, the frontal and parietal cortex, that are smaller if they're more heavily exposed, and they match the neuropsychological deficits. So you talk about the glove fitting in this situation with respect to the evidence for doing the right thing and preventing exposure. Now, I practice in New York City. I practice at Bellevue Hospital, which is the flagship hospital in the New York City public hospital system. So I appreciate that income and access to these foods are not so straightforward sometimes. And I have two things to say in that regard. One is that there is a so-called dirty dozen. There are priority fruits and vegetables, in particular the leafy greens and vegetables where you eat that outer layer are the ones where the pesticide residue is more likely to find its gateway right into the human body. So those are the ones that you want to prioritize in particular. And the great news is we've come a long way in the price points for these foods. Whereas 5 to 7 years ago, I wouldn't routinely suggest it. We've seen an explosion with double-digit gains percentage-wise in market share of organic food compared to conventional, which has essentially been flat, which is why even the big box stores are putting conventional side-by-side with organic. I won't name companies, but because I don't do that for a living. But the reality is we're seeing competition in all places and economic situations and contexts. So that gives me a lot of hope for further momentum in this regard, such that eventually the market share will be so big that organic will almost be a given. By the way, one other benefit of organic is that you automatically get no GMO foods, leaving aside the controversies and difficulties that have come up with that topic. Since I've already talked a lot about flame retardants, let me talk about them next. So California did change the law. California is California, after all. So in 2013, California changed the law to require labeling and documentation and took away the requirement of flame retardants to be added to furniture in particular. So now you can turn the label at your local furniture sales place and you literally can see flame retardant added or not. And the good news is you don't throw out all your furniture. It's where the upholstery is torn or scratched that you have a greater ability for the chemical to come out and ultimately accumulate in dust. Now, I appreciate we've got a lot more wood floor up here compared to New York City and even further south. And that's a good thing because these chemicals can accumulate on carpets. But even if you've got a lot of carpet at home, opening the windows and recirculating the air in 30 to 60 seconds, even in heavily vehicle trafficked areas like New York City, you don't have any deficit from having a little bit of greater urban traffic and therefore more polluted outdoor air coming in as a result. You can get rid of persistent organic pollutants that accumulate not just from flame retardants used in electronics and carpeting, but a variety of other persistent organic pollutants that are in people's lives. In addition, let's talk about food. Microwaving plastics is something that can actually accentuate contamination of these chemicals. And I appreciate microwave safe is on the label of many plastic containers. However, that's misleading. It's meant to be for more gross misshaping and warping of these plastics. And when you heat that in the microwave, you actually enhance the plastic breakdown from polymers, little chains of the same unit of molecule, to monomers that ultimately get into food and then ultimately into our body. The same goes for machine dishwashing plastics, where the harsh chemical ingredients and high temperatures further break the plastic lining down. Also, I'm glad to see not much in the way of plastic bottles here tonight. Most presentations I'm at have a few. But if you do look at that recycling number on the bottom of a plastic bottle, the numbers 3, 6, and 7 are the ones to avoid across the board. If you spike my drink a little bit more, I'll give you a funnier way to remember that, but I won't do it on camera. I apologize. But 3 is for phthalates, which, by the way, I hate to put the adult men on notice. Phthalates inhibit testosterone, the male sex hormone. That's important for sperm function, libido, but it's not just a lifestyle issue. It's actually also literally a life and death matter. We found that 10,000 adult men each year die because of decreases in testosterone in the United States due to phthalate-associated levels in their bodies. So literally the connection is phthalates reduce testosterone. Testosterone, or low T, is a marker for or predictor of adult cardiovascular disease or stroke. That's where the connect the dots comes in that regard. So 3 is for phthalates, 6 is for styrene, a known carcinogen, and 7 is for those bisphenols that I've already talked about. Now, one comment, you've probably heard a lot about BPA-free and what that means or doesn't mean. But just to give you a sense, there are 40 or so artists formerly known as BPA now, including BPS, BPP, BPZ, BPAP, BPF. The bad news is what little we know about one, bisphenol S, is it's as estrogenic, remember DES and BPA, as toxic to embryos, and as persistent in the environment. So we literally are playing chemical whack-a-mole with many of these exposures. And with BPA, unless they say it's non-bisphenol lining, where they've shifted completely to a different class of chemical, you're potentially raising the risk of repeating the problem even with the best of intentions. Which brings me from phthalates to bisphenols. I've already talked about BPA-free and given a little bit of chemical whack-a-mole or regrettable substitution 101. But canned foods across the board are ones I would suggest to avoid, unless they're explicit about non-bisphenol linings in particular. Now, there are some naturally derived linings out there in some companies, including ones you might find at the co-op across the way, give you some guidance about what to do in that respect. But also, when you're at the coffee shop and get that thermal paper receipt, I've got some bad news for you about that, unfortunately. There's a glossy layer which is made of the same chemical, bisphenols, a polycarbonate, an epoxy film that is put on the surface. And when you absorb that glossy layer, you literally absorb it into your skin, and through hand-to-mouth behavior, subconsciously, you can absorb it into your body. What really pains me is the grocer workers or cashiers who handle these all the time, and then have the hand sanitizer that with good intentions to prevent microbial contamination. And that's because when you add hand sanitizer in the mix, it exponentially increases the exposure. 100-fold is the factor of levels that get detected in people's bodies. So there, unfortunately, are as many ways to spike your levels of these exposures as there are to prevent them. Now, this is all quite shocking, but I have a lot of hope. And it comes in examples where we've done the right thing. We have so much power with our pocketbooks, our wallets, with our purses, to be the change we seek and force the companies through their bottom line to do the right thing. Think about BPA-free. It's still not banned in cans, but it's been banned in baby bottles and sippy cups. And it wasn't because of science. It was because of media attention and public outcry that literally made the manufacturers to run to the FDA and say, oh, wait, we changed our manufacturing practices. Please ban BPA to reassure the public and allow us to sell these plastic baby bottles and sippy cups again. Similarly, it took a study of just 5 food packages recently where they have historically used these Teflon-like chemicals for nonstick aspects of the buffet-style food packaging, you know, the ones you go around to pick your famous favorite grocer and stuff some food and run off and eat it on the go. And at these 5 packages, 2 major supermarket chains were found to have levels of perfluoroalkyl substances in their buffet-style food packaging. They ran to their upstream providers and insisted that the upstream providers of these food packages change their manufacturing practices. And you saw it on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. Literally, they shoved their packaging aside and replaced it with something free of the perfluoroalkyl substances. So we talk about individual level impacts. They're big. Our wallet, our pocketbook, no offense, the pocketbooks really matter. But companies that are in the middle can be a force multiplier on behalf of the change we seek. So I've seen a lot of things work, and I've seen a lot of momentum on this issue going forward. But the hope that I have comes most fundamentally in the generation to come. I'm almost too old to see the change I'd like to see in 30 years down the line. And that really comes from the millennial and post-millennial generation that, quite frankly, has taken on climate change with gusto. They're woke to these issues. And similarly, if we can spread the word to that generation as well, that can really exponentiate the message in a population that's already got much more of a deeper dig environmental mindset. Now, I don't want to leave you with the misimpression that you're all stuck with the health problems and can't do anything if you're past, if you're not a millennial or post-millennial. I myself am a Gen Xer. There might be some boomers in the audience. But, and here's why. There are short, medium, and long-term benefits to preventing these exposures in the first place. Avoiding using that cosmetic with phthalate or fragrance may actually reduce your sinus symptoms in the short term in a few days. It might reduce or mitigate the effects on your hormones in a few weeks. And then in a few months, you might reduce your risks for a variety of chronic diseases. By the way, these span the entire life course. Prostate cancer, breast cancer, endometriosis, fibroids. It affects us all. This doesn't just affect moms and babies or the younger generation, for lack of a better term. So I've already seen leaps and bounds in awareness and the change that we seek. And if we keep that momentum up, I think in 10 years' time, we will repeat the story and the advance that we've seen in climate change. And while the politics may seem remote in that regard, in particular, it's the advance that we've seen at the individual level that tells me that whoever's in the White House or the State House, this issue will advance and we will improve our health for the future. So thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
This is Dr. Leonardo Trisandi, author of the book Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future, and What We Can Do About It. He was speaking at the Shaw Institute in Blue Hill on July 3rd. We have time for part of the question and answer session that followed. The questions were off mic, so the audio quality is not the best. Our apologies for that.
Hi. So in risk assessment, I'm always chagrined by the lack of discussion of the magnitude of the risk. And you've talked about magnitude a bit, but can you compare the effects of these four chemicals to other risks?
Sure. So we're not talking about things that kill directly in the same way as we're talking about 7 million people being killed each year from air pollution globally. I would accept that. However, we are talking about, when it comes to impacts on people's lives, the same order of magnitude of adverse impacts in some cases as unhealthy diet and physical activity. To use the analogy of obesity and cardiovascular disease, it's like a three-legged stool. It's not a two-legged stool. Diet and physical activity are clearly the leading drivers of that epidemic, but chemical factors are an important and independent risk factor in line with the same types of impacts on people's lives. Just to use another example, when it comes to chemicals and their impact on cognitive function, we're talking here and there about 2, 3 to 5 IQ points. Those are the same kinds of increments that can have huge economic consequences and drive people to act on much less. So I think when people try to minimize these risk factors vis-a-vis things that might kill people. I appreciate that none of these chemical exposures directly kill people, but breast cancer, prostate cancer, endometriosis, fibroids can, and the cardiovascular risks I talked about with phthalates through decreases in testosterone are on that same order of magnitude. I hope I addressed the crux of your question. I may have danced around it a bit.
Well, I feel like part of the problem is that just what you said, people can't really perceive it very much, that something is happening. They don't keel right over. So how can we help people understand that this is really, that they'll gain tremendously in their health and vitality if they do pay attention to these things? And it's not too hard to do. How do we do that?
Well, I would say awareness will take us a long way. I mean, climate change doesn't do the same thing immediately in the here and the now to each of us in a similar way. I don't think you need that kind of, you don't need people. If healthcare policy were solely acting based on who, what kills people, there would be a lot of things that we're not doing today. We're in the same order of magnitude. Healthy diet and physical activity are in that same range. It's not like we die from not from being physically inactive for a day or two. We're talking about risks in the same order of magnitude and effect. I do think we're approaching a future where we will consider testing these chemicals in people side by side with some of the laboratory values that we usually think about, like cholesterol, sodium, etc. But we're still a ways away from that, because all the safe and simple steps I've talked about can be taken without measuring a chemical body burden. Now, it's been done. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention does it biannually in everyone in national surveys to document the exposures, but we're still at a research phase in using that data in an effective way. So you don't need to show the change in level to change people's behavior. You tell people what to do, and then the level does change as a result. But that doesn't mitigate the magnitude of these effects in people's lives. Wow, great group of questions. I'm going to go in the back. I think you were waiting.
What about the plastics and sunscreen?
Oh, you mean the microplastics? And so what little we know is that they have impacts on wildlife. In particular, that's why Hawaii did a major piece of legislation that actually had national impact, because of the impact on coral reefs. But the chemicals in these in those are the oxybenzones and other organic chemicals, with the idea that they absorb readily into your skin the way we deliver drugs through these nanoparticles and microparticles. So I'm not indicting the size of the particles and the microplastics from a human health perspective. It's what comes along for the ride, and unfortunately the concern about these is that it may not actually be a dose related phenomenon. We already know that the dose doesn't necessarily make the poison. We know that there are low level effects and effects that don't follow regular straight lines, that due to the way hormones occur, things can go up and down more like a roller coaster ride with respect to the exposure. But to get to the bottom line in terms of what I suggest to people about sunscreen, it's the old school zinc oxide and titanium based oxide, the ones where you literally can see the sunscreen in, as opposed to the one that absorbs into your body. It's really about that barrier at the front line of your skin that's really going to have the greatest impact. And we're already seeing the Food and Drug Administration start to document the awareness and the concern about the chemicals used in these sunscreens. And I suspect legislation is close, if not going to happen in this Congress, to further advance the way chemicals are regulated in personal care products. It's been 80 years since that part of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act has been updated. So suffice it to say, there's been a lot of science in the past 80 years. Thank you for the question.
In addition to, you've been talking a lot about not ingesting these chemicals, either through eating them or through our skin, but how do you suggest, once they're in us, that we detox, in addition to exercising?
So I am not a fan of detoxing with intentional chemical additives, and simply because the chemicals that are out there that are being advertised and the other non-chemical methods, A, are not proven to have the health benefits that have been promised and may actually have adverse impacts on health. Really, the message here is about proactive prevention of these exposures. There's so much, as I've described, that you can do with benefits in the immediate term that I also don't think it's worth it to litigate the past. Yes, we carry a variety of exposures that may contribute to harm, but the fact is there's so much we can change now. So the mindset is look forward, not backward.
So I'm a scared consumer right now. I feel chemicals are everywhere, and it's really hard for me to get away from them, no matter how many talks I go to. What I want to know is, you have the knowledge
Do you ever talk to a room full of manufacturers of these chemicals?
Yes.
Good.
Yes. So I want to say a couple things that are in your comments. So notice that I steered very much on a synthetic chemicals line. We're all made of chemicals. Let's just be candid about that. There is this thing called dihydrogen oxide. I mean, there are people I have run into and talked to accuse me of chemophobia. Hardly. The reality here is we're focusing on, particularly on four categories of chemicals, about 1,000 chemicals of concern. And we need to focus our attention, because if you get into the noise of the next chemical of the day, you get so blinded by the aggregate of data, you don't know what to prioritize. So in this message is really practical, low-hanging fruit steps that you can do to improve your life in the short, medium, and long term, regardless of age and stage. Yep.
So how long will it be before the majority of pediatricians can give this simple advice to young mothers?
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics has a report in hand on food additives that I was privileged to be a part of in 2018. Before that, in 2013, don't hold me to that year, Joel Foreman, a colleague of mine at Mount Sinai in New York City, led a report that documented the effect of these of pesticides in foods. So it's not like the medical establishment is all there on this, don't get me wrong, but they're making a lot of progress. And you may know that medical education tends to be a bit staid. There's a resistance because there's a lot of competition in the space. I mean, the diet people, the nutrition people get really angry when I bring up endocrine disrupting chemicals, but I'm not into competing with them. Actually, I think these messages go hand in hand. You can talk about eating lower salt foods or non-trans fat foods in the same beat as you talk about not microwaving your plastic and avoiding canned food. It's not that hard. And actually, some of these messages go beautifully hand in hand and mutually reinforce each other. For example, eating highly processed foods, which is a study after study is being associated with cardiovascular mortality. Some of that is chemicals and some of that is diet. This is a bad analogy. You can have your cake and eat it too. So I'll hit this a bit more in depth from a variety of angles. Sorry, I wanted to, sometimes I preemptively strike on things like chemophobia because I think you actually hit that beautifully. So I wanted to use that question as a way to go there. But just to get to your question. So from the perspective of what we're doing to address the industry in these debates. So, and there's a role for policy, don't get me wrong. But we've seen that the states, even if the federal government doesn't address an issue, the states, through individual actions, can actually set the table in a way that it becomes painfully obvious that the chemical industry has to get with the program and negotiate a reasonable science-based package of regulation at the federal level. So the Toxic Substances Control Act was first written in 1976, hadn't been updated until President Obama signed the update in 2016. That would not have happened if, I can pick my states, Maine, New York, Washington, California, others, didn't step up and say, no, BPA is not allowed here. Phthalates are not allowed here. And then it became this weird box that was being structured for the chemical industry. And the chemical industry doesn't like to have multiple versions of a product. They can't make a California product as opposed to a New York product, let alone a Maine product. However, they do make European products differently from the US products. So we need to actually work in a variety of ways. There's this thing called federalism, which I'm a huge fan of, for this very reason. We're seeing it in food in particular. So the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, when it comes to food chemicals, hasn't been updated since the 1960s. It's not as bad as cosmetics, but it's still problematic. And there's a lot of antiquated principles of science beneath the legislation to boot. Not to mention this massive loophole called generally recognized as safe that allows a lot of chemicals just to be slipped in saying, we think it's all fine. True. So there are a variety of ways where we talk about this. sometimes it's not the most straightforward to communicate it directly to the industry, but it's educating the medical professionals, it's educating the environmental advocates, the environmental experts, the legislators, and working with a variety of non-governmental organizations that can carry the voice in a way that's even louder and more effective than we can as individual scientists. Scientists, we're not paid to do these kinds of events routinely. We have to rely on partners to communicate that message and propel it forward. So I hope I gave these two questions their proper justice. So thank you for piping in. Hi.
As I shared with you earlier, I was in the field of education, and we were involved with the concept of early intervention, prevention, and identification. And the program worked with pediatric neurologists out of Boston, MGH. The concern was we were seeing more kids with Asperger's, attention deficit, all sorts of early childhood issues. And when we would have clinics trying to identify kids that were at high risk, parents were looking for quick fixes. What can I do? Young mothers, do I do something different? Do I feed them something different? Do I not put the downy in the dryer because I heard that causes all kinds of problems?
Yep.
From a pediatric point of view, the focus shifted to what can we do in terms of intervention? I mean, what do we really do for high-risk kids that can help them get a kind of head start rather than waiting to identify them as handicapped or special needs? And I'd be interested in the whole concept of early identification, prevention, and intervention, what your thoughts are on that.
So I have a few thoughts on how I want to approach it that may not be directly related to your question, but may relate to other questions that are in the audience. I'm going to do a 3 or 4 for 1 deal, maybe.
Well, the issue is parents panicking,
yep,
wanting a quick fix.
And this pains me because I get a lot, sometimes I get a question, well, what do you think about vaccines? Which in many ways of late has been this third rail issue around the potential that it might contribute to autism. When there's just no science compared to the science that shows that flame retardants, pesticides, methyl mercury, not the ethyl mercury that's found in the one, I'm talking about the one in fish, not the one in vaccines, and lead among other chemicals are more likely candidates to affect the brains of these children in ways that it might be more plausibly related to autism and neurocognitive disabilities. So it's almost when I hear a mom or a dad, I'm not saying it's a mom only, or anyone, get enraged about vaccines and their child who they say is vaccine injured, if you almost want to give them a hug and say, I want to work with you to try to understand the preventable factors and look at all the science that's telling us things that we can do now to prevent these exposures in pregnancy so we don't repeat the legacy again of these synthetic chemicals that may actually be substantially more likely to be contributors than the vaccines, which have been studied all sorts of different ways, be it the metals that are in there to the vaccine number and the timing and things like that. So I didn't mean to use that as a vehicle for that, but I sensed in your question this pain point that you feel like your parents are basically searching for their at ends. Right. And that's the difficulty of this, is I can't point to an individual child. And I can't roll back the clock because many of these chemicals have done a hit and run. The exposure was in pregnancy. It exited the body in 24 to 48 hours. It's not in the child. With the epigenome, this notion that genes get modified not just in the A, C, G, and T, but there might be signals that relate to the chemical exposure's fingerprints that are left behind that may also be linked to autism. We might be able to do that detective work, but I still say we're 20 years or so away. I mean, this is me doing this, right? In terms of number of years, but I think it's 20 or so before we really can get that together. So, and environmental histories and things like that don't give you justice because there's so many exposures in the environment. We need to rely on research studies to look at this at a population level. So that's what's really challenging about this, is I can't as a pediatrician say, oops, that was a pesticide exposure in utero or that was a flame retardant or whatever, or something postnatally that might have done. I can't do that right now. And that's what complicates the messaging around this in particular, is that you can't do a blood test to say, that was it. And we do, and but this similar to the Human Genome Project. You know, I love the Human Genome Project. It's actually do so much with our understanding of environmental contaminants. But for many conditions, it's identified the 1% or 2% leading contributors, single gene mutations that contribute to these kinds of conditions. And it's a similar, we're in a similar conundrum there as well. But there's a lot that we can do even without that data to prevent the next generation, because families that are growing are going to potentially have other children. And that's an opportunity, especially in a high-risk population, let's say a mom who has a child who is on the spectrum. The mom may get pregnant again. And that's an opportunity to intervene to prevent these exposures going forward in the future. So that's how I bring it all back, ultimately saying, like, yes, I appreciate your child has this condition. Let's talk about safe and simple steps you could do to limit toxic exposures later.
Tough sell.
Tough sell, I agree. Yes, hi.
Thanks. So I'm supposed to know about this stuff. I'm a doctor. I treat patients with certain noxious environmental exposures, but I don't know where the phthalates are, where, you know, what I should be advising people to do. The furniture now has a lot more foam in it than it used to. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem? Should, you know, people are sleeping on beds that are made entirely of foam.
Understood.
Can you, again, give us more context for our lives?
So I think tonight what I've done is given you the most I can give you in an hour without putting you to sleep, and it wouldn't be the wine. And at the same time, as a fellow clinician, you recognize there's only so much that a visit can bear in terms of communication information. You've probably seen this in the families you've interacted with. There's only maybe two or three things that you can really take away in that kind of visit, and you have to write them down. I mean, I have to do this all the time. Regardless of income, stage, age, and life, whatever. You have to, so there's a lot in here. Yeah. You might not get them to do everything on the first try. You might bring them back in 3 months and they say, I did that, but I didn't do that, doc, sorry. And then you say, okay, well, here's one new thing, and here, let's focus on this other thing, and I'm writing it down again for you. So it's all about working in steps. If you get overwhelmed by the broader environment and all the exposures in people's lives, you'll get lost ultimately. And it may not be the big, it's not necessarily grounded in the science that we have for these exposures that I can tell you have the data to support action in the here and the now. So it really comes back to those safe and simple steps that we can do that are proven to have impact.
That was a talk by Dr. Leonardo Trasandi called Chemicals Hacking Hormones and Fueling Epidemics. You also heard part of the question and answer session that followed. It was recorded at the Shaw Institute in Blue Hill on July 3rd, 2019 by Matt Murphy. Dr. Trasandi is an internationally recognized expert on EDCs and author of the book Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. I'm Amy Brown. Stay tuned for On the Wing coming up next here on Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and streaming online at weru.org.